This week, as you may know by now, the government decided to make some changes to our money. Harriet Tubman will appear on the $20 bill, though Andrew Jackson will stay on the back. Hamilton stays on the 10, and several women's rights and civil rights leaders will be pictured on other bills. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And just like our money, our economy is always in flux, changing to adapt to, say, global trade or the backlash against it, changing the way we buy, use, and waste commodities, and even shifting the very identity of companies as they try to figure out what works now and what might work in the future. Come talk to us about your changing economy on our website, marketplace.org, the Marketplace Facebook page, or follow us on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We're starting the show, as we do most weeks, with our take on some terms from the financial world, long and short. This is when we ask smart people what they're betting on or against in the world of news and current events. This week, we have our own Kimberly Adams, who's joining us from St. Louis Public Radio, and Leah Labresco from the website 538. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start with you, Leah. You're the new kid here. Tell me what you're long.
Well, I'm long Hillary Clinton at the moment. After New York's primary, she was already ahead, but we've really passed the point at which people should be seriously speculating that Bernie's going to come back. He needs to win almost 60% of the remaining delegates to wind up with a majority at this point.
Yeah, you guys are the numbers people.
Yeah, and you know, this is the thing. There's always a temptation to spin races as more competitive than they are because people don't really want to watch too many stories about races that have ended.
I mean, excluding you guys who are, as Lizzie said, the numbers people, I'm actually going to jump on and add that I think we're going to see a lot more math experts come into our realm of existence in the coming weeks as people suddenly become experts on delegate math, especially on the Republican side. The different formulations I have seen and how the 12th Amendment may have to get pulled in and what we would see from the House weighing in, it's getting crazy.
I mean, you don't need math experts at this point, you need Robert's Rules of Order nerds who can talk about exactly who can raise motions and what rules they can break and so on. It's going to be a great time for some of the people I went to college with.
I'm fascinated by this. I mean, I know that we had an open convention in 1976 on the GOP side, but man, I feel like for a lot of people, we are in uncharted territory here.
Especially the people who've not really seen that many elections. I mean, this election in particular seems to be pulling in a lot of new voters. And for people who previously maybe weren't super engaged in the political process to watch the way this is playing out, I'm hoping it won't turn them off forever.
Well, it's interesting. It's closer almost to the historical model of the way parties have worked in the U.S., where the party gets to put a thumb on the scale. And we're used to these races feeling a lot more like straight democracy.
That's true. That's a really interesting point. Kimberly, what are you long?
I am unfortunately going to go long on the Flint water crisis. This issue is not going away. In some ways, that's good because the attention obviously needs to be paid to what's happening in that community and the fact that people there are still struggling. But the downside of it is that struggle is continuing. And this week, we saw criminal charges being filed against three people who the attorney general believes were criminally culpable for what happened there. And there are even more lawsuits in the pipeline that are going to keep this issue moving forward for quite some time.
It's hard to imagine this ending anytime soon, even as the criminal convictions possibly come down, because it's such a long wait for justice here when a lot of the effects of the lead poisoning will last sometimes even to the second generation.
One of the things that struck me when I was there, which was toward the end of January, are these developmental costs, Leah, that you're talking about. So the school district there had a $10 million budget deficit when I talked to the superintendent, and they only had one nurse. They're getting more. But if you're trying to think about how a place moves forward, it's really hard if you can't hire people because you can't pay them. Kimberly, give us your short.
I am going short on VW. Their balance sheets are about to look terrible. So Volkswagen this week is struck a deal where they are going to offer consumers who bought these cars that broke all sorts of environmental standards, and Volkswagen lied about it and deceived regulators, Volkswagen has struck a deal that will basically give the people who bought those cars the option of having Volkswagen either buy them back or fix them. And it's going to cost them a ton of money, not to mention the fact that they are still already having to deal with their issues with the Department of Justice and the EPA. Yeah, they're going to have a tough time for a while yet.
I wonder how you wait that they're in the news again because they're doing the buyback versus the goodwill a buyback generates.
Would it be goodwill and in the sense of justice, or more like it's about time?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, their stock has actually moved up over the past, month or so. And I wonder how much of that is the sort of old chestnut that markets like certainty. So if they're saying, OK, well, you're going to have a settlement and there's an environmental fund, but I don't know. I don't know how that plays out over the long term. And you're right, Kimberly, that we don't know what the buybacks are really going to look like from a financial standpoint, over the next couple of months.
It does make me kind of hanker to quantify the half-life of trust lost, right? Where you look at Chipotle with their norovirus outbreak and Lenovo with their spyware that was on their computers. How long does it take for people to return to their previous buying habits, especially for something where turnover is slow for a computer or a car?
But every time you get into that car, you're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Leah Labresco from 538, Kimberly Adams from Marketplace. Thank you both very much.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Now we've got a story about changes in the way we use food. A couple of weeks ago, we asked you, our listeners, about what you waste. And a lot of you wrote to us about food. And food waste here in the U.S. is a pretty big deal. $162 billion of American food is wasted every year. That's according to a new campaign from the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Ad Council. Marketplace's Annie Baxter covers food and agriculture for us, and she's been looking at both the campaign and the larger issue of food waste. Hi, Annie.
Hey there.
You cover food. You've been looking into this. But put some numbers on the amount of money and food that we waste.
Well, an average family of four wastes about $1,500 a year on food that goes uneaten. That's according to the Natural Resources Defense Council. It's one of the groups behind this new ad campaign. And I talked to Dana Gunders, a scientist with the group, and she helped put that number into perspective.
For many households, it's about 20% of the food they buy, which is crazy. It's like walking out of the grocery store with five bags, dropping one in the parking lot, and not even bothering to pick it up.
That's such an arresting image. How does that happen?
Well, it really kind of is death by a thousand cuts. We may not plan before going to the grocery store and make a lot of impulse buys. Portion sizes have gotten a lot bigger. So if we eat out, we might be served with way more food than we actually want. I actually had a funny occurrence on that front a couple months ago when I was meeting with someone to talk about food waste over lunch. And I was given this gigantic meal, and I was like, I know I'm supposed to be taking this home with me so I don't waste food, but I don't want to eat this because it wasn't very good quality food. So
this is something that we heard from listeners when we sort of asked them about what they waste, and they were talking about food. Well, what are the tips that we have to, I guess, change our behavior?
The website that's affiliated with this ad campaign, SaveTheFood.com, has a whole list of tips. And so it ranges from, menu planning down to things like wrapping leftover cheese in wax paper instead of plastic and realizing that food lasts longer than you think. So veggies can wilt some and still be edible. And then, those stamps on perishable foods that say sell by, use by, best before, those are really just guidelines. The website indicates, a lot of times you can eat that food well beyond those dates.
It seems like it would make sense. Okay, you waste less, you save more. But food isn't a global market, and some people were kind of skeptical to you when you talked about this.
Yeah, this one ag economist I talked to, Vince Smith, said there's a lot of reasons why people just are not really going to notice the money that they're wasting or losing on food waste. And part of the issue is that food is, really abundant and relatively cheap. So food prices since 1975 have grown more slowly on an inflation-adjusted basis than other prices in the Consumer Price Index. And Smith added that, given these factors and the value we place on our time, we might not want to plan out our menus or organize the fridge so that we don't have stuff rotting away in there because, you know, there just isn't a huge financial incentive to do so. And I also heard some interesting contrarian thoughts from a marketing professor named Vlad Grishkabichus at the University of Minnesota, who's done a lot of work on what it takes to get people to engage in greener behaviors. He said, first off, if people are given a lot of different options about how to change, that can just be too overwhelming and they might not really end up doing anything. So keeping the tip simple matters. But he's also found that the thing that really compels people to act in more environmentally friendly ways is not telling them this is going to help the environment or that they're going to save money, but it helps to play into their desire to keep up with the Joneses. So,
wow.
Yeah. So he says it can be counterproductive for a campaign like this one, the Save the Food campaign, to point out how much food is being wasted. It would be better, he says, to point out how many other people out there are trying not to waste.
A lot of the campaigns I see that try to change people's behavior start off by showing how many people waste food. And their intention is to draw attention to the problem, to say, guys, look at this issue. We have to do something about it. But in reality, it tends to backfire because it's telling us, well, this is what people do. People just like you and me waste food all the time. And that might actually get people to waste even more food.
So with that in mind, it'll be kind of interesting to see how well this Save the Food ad campaign works.
I have to say, I have changed my behavior because my sister-in-law is an incredible food reuser and saver, and she's sort of inspired slash shamed me, and it's worked.
Totally. Peer pressure does a lot.
Marketplace's Annie Baxter, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For next week's show, we want to talk with you about family leave. Several states are enacting laws to provide some kind of paid family leave. What would that mean for you, for your budget? Do you think that should even be the government's job? Come tell us about how you'd like to see family leave work at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. This next week, the debate over impeaching Brazil's president Dilma Rousseff will move to that country's Senate. The lower house has already voted to impeach her, and Brazil has been in an ongoing state of crisis. There have been protests in the streets, both for and against Rousseff, and a massive recession that's damaged what was once the crown jewel of South America's economy and has implications for all of us. For an update on the mess, we turn to our partners at the BBC and their South America business correspondent, Daniel Gallas, who is based in São Paulo and talked to us via Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's back up a little bit. If you haven't been following this incredibly closely, how did we get to this moment in Brazil?
Well, it was only about a year and a half ago that President Dilma Rousseff was elected by the majority of Brazilians. Rousseff ran a campaign where she promised that she would keep Brazil under a stimulus policy in its economy. But as soon as she was elected, she changed that stance into austerity. So she did a very radical shift in the economy, and she said that that was needed because the global outlook changed throughout that period. The people who voted for her felt she had betrayed their ideals. The people who voted for the opposition candidate accused her of lying. On top of that, there was a major corruption investigation into the state oil company Petrobras. Throughout the year, Brazil also had its worst economic performance in over two decades. It was downgraded by all major credit ratings agencies and also saw its GDP contract by almost 4%. Mm. Millions of jobs were lost. So in one year, things changed very radically, both in politics and in the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I was there a year ago. I remember you and I talking in São Paulo, and it just seems like Brazil has done an incredible turn from where we were just a year ago.
Yes, well, a lot of the problems that Brazil has been experiencing, had been experiencing in the past year, they started long ago, and they have a lot to do with China and with what many economists call the new normal in China. Since 2011, commodities have not been as pricey as before, which were a major drive in the Brazilian economy, and China has been buying a lot less from Brazil. What happened was that between 2011 and 2014, around the time you were here last year, Brazil was still under those stimulus policies. The government was trying to spend its way out of crisis and using its own budget to tackle the slowdown in the global economy. But Brazil is now out of money.
Let's talk a little bit about the vice president, Michel Temer. He is not in Dilma Rousseff's party. What happens if he assumes power, even only for a short period of time?
The shortest period of time he would be a president is 6 months, because that's how long a trial for President Rousseff would last in case she is suspended in early May. In that case, there's a lot happening in Brazil in that period. There are municipal elections in October, and there are the Olympic Games in August. But Temer's main challenge will be the economy. He has to get a hold of Congress, and he has to approve many economic reforms. A lot of these reforms are quite similar to what President Rousseff has had already been doing, which is pretty much austerity, trying to get Brazil's budget in line, cutting spending and raising taxes. That's basically what he plans to do. And that's what President Rousseff was trying to do, but a lot of people lost confidence that she wasn't able to do that because she didn't deliver on austerity last year.
Do you think we would be seeing this kind of political crisis if the Brazilian economy was still humming along where it was 5 years ago?
Probably not. President Rousseff has been under fire for many things, but no one, even her political opponents, doubt that she's an honest politician. The whole impeachment process is based on her allegedly mishandling the budget accounts and committing a fiscal crime. And the reason why she did that was because she basically had to somehow meet a surplus target for the budget in Brazil. And she was not going to get that from the real numbers. So she's accused of doctoring those numbers. So even the accusations for her impeachment wouldn't happen if she wasn't under pressure to deliver on the budget and on the economy.
Brazil had so many people join the middle class over the past 10 years with spending power, and they were, you know, traveling abroad, spending money there. I wonder, as this continues and as Brazil is in this deep recession, what does this mean for Brazil's kind of interconnectedness in the global economy?
It's very tough for people, and it's happening very rapidly. We saw that the purchasing power of the Brazilian currency has decreased a lot in the past year, so Brazilians are spending less abroad. But the most radical changes are happening at home. I talked to many maids, servants, domestic workers in Brazil who were a huge chunk of the workforce a few years ago. And as Brazil's economy started improving, they were actually leaving those jobs and getting jobs in the industry, getting more salaries and better living standards. Many of those maids who had left that business are now going back into the domestic service because industries are shutting down jobs. So part of the population are going back to worse jobs than they had a few years ago. The one positive note about all this is that throughout these good years, many of these sort of emerging classes, they managed to get their kids through college or through better schools. So there's hope that at least in the future, that there will be some benefits from those good years.
Daniel Gallas, South American business correspondent for the BBC, our partners there. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
To take a deeper look now at an issue that's been a big focus in this presidential campaign on both sides, and that is global trade. It's emotional, complicated, and really resonates with people. If you look at exit polls from this week's New York primary, for example, 43% of Democrats told CNN that trade costs jobs, and only 37% said it creates them. And on the GOP side, Donald Trump has made trade, particularly with China, a centerpiece of his campaign. To unpack this and look at the economics behind the rhetoric and demystify it, we turn to our own in-house expert, Tracy Samuelson, who covers trade for Marketplace. Hi, Tracy.
Hey, Lizzie.
Why is trade such a compelling and resonant issue on both sides of the aisle right now, do you think?
Trade is always an issue during elections, but this year I think it's building on a lot of frustration from a lot of blue-collar workers, perhaps, who have had a rough couple of decades.
Yeah, and stagnant incomes, stagnant wages.
Stagnant incomes, you know, and are looking at our country's huge trade deficits and thinking that is money flowing out of the U.S., flowing away from me.
A lot of the conversation, I would say, in the past 20 years or so, there has been something of an orthodoxy among economists that, on balance, global trade was a positive thing. Has that changed now? And if so, how?
Yeah, so the sort of classic argument is there are winners and losers in trade, but the winners outnumber the losers. And I think you will find most economists still support that idea. What you're seeing is some recognition that we've sort of underestimated just how acute the impacts of trade might be for those losers and how prolonged it might be.
Do you see a conversation also about, okay, well, it certainly could mean that jobs have been offshored somewhere. On the other hand, that also probably means that I might have a smartphone or my kids can buy T-shirts at a lower cost. All of the other things that fit into that picture. Do people's minds display kind of malleability about that or not?
Yeah, it's funny because if you, you know, think about people and their love of the iPhone, like they're not like, oh, thanks, trade. You know, I've benefit. This is a benefit of trade. Whereas if someone loses their job due to increased competition abroad, like that is, you're like, hey, that is
yeah.
a very specific thing that I am feeling in my life. The benefits are much more diffuse. But I should also say that when if you look at polls, I mean, so there is a very vocal opposition to trade and trade agreements right now. But if you look at polls, like we have a recent poll from Gallup, and they've been tracking this question for a very long time, I think since the early 90s, how do Americans feel about trade? Hmm. So as of February, 58% of Americans view foreign trade as an opportunity for economic growth versus 34% who see it as a threat to the economy.
So it's still in the positive.
So it's still in the positive, and it has been since about 2013. Now, Bloomberg did a similar poll but asked the question a slightly different way, and they sort of saw the opposite results. I think that gets to just how confusing this is for people, the benefits versus the costs. You know, in a marketplace, we did our own poll, and the first question we asked people was, do you think a trade is good for the American economy or bad for the American economy, or you don't know enough to say? And half of respondents said, I don't know enough to say.
You spent some time with Michael Froman, the U.S. trade representative, as he's been sort of going around, I guess you could say, what, stumping for these trade agreements that the administration is trying
to build support.
What was that like, and what did you find?
So he's the guy who goes out and negotiates trade agreements. And, you know, I spent this very long day with him, and at the end, you know, we're in the car kind of finally wrapping up, and I asked him about how you change people's minds on a topic like this, because it is, as we've been saying, so kind of emotional and confusing. And this was his answer.
We're not going to be able to change everybody's minds, and that's not our goal. It's not what's necessary. I hope that people who have an open mind to the facts, to what's actually in the agreement, will take the time to learn that, to ask questions, to press us on the issues that are of concern to them, and let us answer the concerns that they have, and then come to their judgment. If you have already made up a decision and are closed-minded about it, then there's unfortunately not much opportunity to have a real dialogue.
That's just amazing tape to me, because he's the guy, right? He's the persuader, and yet he's admitting people have really calcified opinions about this stuff.
Yeah, and I think he's really hopeful that there are a lot of people who are going to come to this agreement and try and evaluate it on its merits. But the administration also has been really vocal about trying to convince people that this isn't a previous trade agreement, right? Hmm. Like President Obama has said that, you know, previous trade agreements maybe didn't live up to the hype. And so they're trying to get people to look at this with fresh eyes. But people really have this sort of like, if you say NAFTA to someone, that means something very specific. And a lot of people will come to that with kind of negative connotations.
Looking ahead, because there is this varied and really vibrant in many ways, conversation about trade that's happening right now in this election season. Do you think that changes the calculus for the Obama administration in trying to move the TPP forward?
Yeah, I think it's made it a lot harder. You know, I think it makes it harder for any member of Congress to say, I support this agreement or to talk about moving forward with a vote. I don't think anybody thinks that a vote now is going to happen before the elections. And it's whether or not it happens after the elections. All the leading candidates right now, none of them support the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, who covers trade for us. Thank you, Tracy.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Economic populism, no matter how you define it, is a big theme in this campaign year, and it's one we're going to continue to examine as we move toward November. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Now to a segment we call Local Money, where we zero in on stories that are affecting economies around the country. This week, we're looking at Austin, Texas, and its struggle with how to address the city's homeless population. That's after the murder of a University of Texas undergraduate by a homeless man. He's been charged, but the killing has ignited intense debate over what to do about the homeless and homelessness in Austin. Kristen Capps is a writer with City Lab at The Atlantic, and he's been covering this. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we've talked on this show about homelessness. A lot of cities around the U.S. have to deal with big homeless issues, but it sounds particularly severe in Austin. Can you put some scope on this for me?
Yes, the problem is really growing with the affordability crisis in Austin, as home prices have really exploded there, as the population has grown there in ways that are unrivaled by most cities and metro areas in the United States. The homelessness crisis has also grown very dramatically. On any given day, the city can register close to 2,300, 2,500 people experiencing homelessness.
One of the things that obviously has brought this discussion to the fore is the murder of this University of Texas student. But Austin seems to have a somewhat complicated relationship with its homeless population. I remember there was this issue over people wanting homeless people to be roving Wi-Fi hotspots during South by Southwest. It seems like there's a lot going on in Austin with these different populations colliding.
Yeah, that's right. It's a college town. The University of Texas is the center of the city. It's the heart of the city. So you have on a campus in which people experiencing homelessness, you know, cannot come onto the campus. But all around, you have homeless people who are living on the streets. And when you have this collision of students, parents, their concerns about the safety for themselves and their children, and their beliefs about homelessness coming into direct contact with people who are homeless, then you have a lot of tension.
You know, a lot of this, as you said, is rooted in affordable housing and the lack thereof. How does that figure into the picture? Because Austin has developed a ton economically over the past decade. Are people just being priced out?
Yes, that's right. The majority of people who are experiencing homelessness in Austin and in a lot of places are not chronically homeless. They are, you know, temporarily homeless. There are people who have been priced out, people who have been evicted, people who what they need most is a kind of transition to get back on their feet, whether that takes the form of charity or public assistance is a question that they know how to solve. Homelessness advocates in Austin and many other cities actually know what they need to do it, but the resources are just not there to cover these gaps.
So what happens next? I mean, how does the city deal with this? And obviously one of their big kind of stakeholders, the university as well.
Well, you have some people who are expressing a lot of concern about this. I mean, this is a very high-profile murder. Haruka Weiser was a child, the person who has been arrested as a suspect. The lead suspect for her murder is also a child, someone who was a ward of the state, drummed out of foster care system. And that those people are not even counted in the traditional homelessness tabulations. So while you have a lot of growing concerns about this, you also have a lot of growing awareness about the situation in Austin. I've talked to homelessness advocates there who have told me that There are more people within real estate coming forward, volunteering even property to help with this issue. There are more people going out on the given day homelessness tabulations to find out how many people are really there. So the problem is, though, growing as the awareness of the problem is growing. So you really, I think, do need government resources to address this problem. And that's just hard to come by.
Yeah. Do you think that's going to happen?
I don't know. The city is a very liberal city, but the problem is enormous. And when people tend to think about the affordability crisis in Austin, I think they're thinking about their rents, they're thinking about their homes, and they're thinking about their property taxes. And a lot of times those thoughts tend to occlude what we ought to be doing for people who are homeless. But we know the solution. So that's something that I think has been arrived at in very recent years with Housing First and other strategies. So at least the path to solving this problem is a lot clearer.
Kristen Capps is a writer for the Atlantic City Lab. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
What's the most important money story where you live? Come tell us. Go to marketplace.org and click on Local Money. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. No matter who you are, you probably had a job that changed you, or you learned a financial lesson that stuck with you. On this show, we ask actors, writers, and other notable people to open up and tell us about how money plays a role in their life. This week, Top Chef winner, Breaking Borders host, and LA chef Michael Voltaggio takes our money-inspired questionnaire. It's called the Marketplace Quiz, and here he is with our producer, Eliza Mills.
My name is Michael Voltaggio. I'm a chef in Los Angeles, California. I have a couple restaurants here. Inc. is the main one. And I occasionally play myself on television, too.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you
dinner at one of my restaurants.
What does it buy you?
Wow. I am a car fanatic, so I guess I would say that. But more importantly, I would say a plane ticket. Just to go somewhere and experience something different.
If you weren't a chef in your next life, what would your career be?
When I was a kid, I wanted to be a rodeo clown, and I have no idea why. I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world. You know, you've got this crazy animal and the cowboy riding it. No one ever gave credit to the rodeo clown, like the guy that was out there, like putting himself out there to like save the cowboy's life. Like the rodeo clown gets to save the cowboy. I mean, how cool is that? The cowboy's usually the one that saves everyone else.
Is cooking ever like being a rodeo clown?
I think in a lot of cases it is, yeah, for sure. It's very chaotic. There's a lot going on. And, you know, in some cases, you know, before the kitchen walls came down and everyone was sort of in front of the audience, you know, you were sort of the rodeo clown back there. You're the guy that wasn't really getting the credit. You were just that weird person that was in the kitchen making this food. The work was being done, but the praise was happening on the other side of the wall.
What's the hardest part of your job that nobody knows about?
I think the hardest part about my job today is balancing everything, being more than what I signed up to be. I signed up to be a cook, eventually wanted to be a chef, but I didn't sign up to be a CEO, a president of a company, a television personality. And so it's figuring out how to do all of those things that I was never really educated to do.
When did you realize that being a cook or a chef could be an actual career for you?
And it's the only job that I've ever had. Since I was 15 years old, I started working in restaurants. I'm 37 years old now, and I've only been paid to really be a chef, or a cook for that matter. Understanding that there was something more to working in the food service industry than just working in the food service industry. I remember, like, when I told my parents, you know, I'm not going to go to college. I'm going to, you know, go to this culinary apprenticeship. I'm going to work, you know, in restaurants. And it was like, oh, yeah, I kind of figured you'd end up in the food service industry. And now it's like, wow, we're really proud of you. So there's this kind of, you know, we didn't make it that way. And I remember seeing the executive chefs of the places that I worked and thinking, like, yeah, one day I'm going to have a decent job. I didn't think that I would have such an amazing career.
What was your first job?
My first job, I was a busboy at a Holiday Inn hotel in Frederick, Maryland, and my brother was the sous chef in the kitchen. I wanted to work in the kitchen, and I remember the other sous chef and my brother said, okay, come in tomorrow dressed in a cook's uniform with the apron, the hat, the chef jacket, the whole thing, and we'll start you in the kitchen on the garmanger, which is the cold station. So I show up the next day, I'm all excited, I get up early, I get to work, I'm 15, 16 years old, and I'm dressed like a chef. Well, Brian and the other sous chef were both off, and the executive chef was there, and he looked at me, and he just basically said, what is this, effing Halloween? Like, what are you supposed to be? They never told him that I was coming in not as a busboy the next day, but as a cook in the kitchen, and so he just, from that day on, mopped the floor with me.
But clearly, it was in some way inspiring to you.
I didn't love so much the... Maybe I did love the drama that was in the kitchen. Maybe there was a little bit of me that really enjoyed the, not the yelling and screaming, but the intensity of it. But then when the creative process was exposed to me and I could see, like, wait a second, I can take all of these ingredients over here and I can make my own dish out of it if I want to, and I can sell it in the restaurant tonight, and that's okay. That empowerment at that age and being able to experience that and then have people hopefully say that they enjoyed it, for me was one of the most inspiring things I've ever experienced in my life.
What's your most prized possession?
I collect a lot of cookbooks, and I know that's an obvious one, but it helped me a lot, especially last year I was cooking in a lot of different countries, and I would show up and try and understand the cuisine there, and so the first thing I would do is go to a bookstore and try and find a cookbook that was written in English. I now have hundreds of cookbooks.
What's something that everyone should own, no matter the cost?
I think everyone should probably own a Vitamix blender. That piece of equipment is in every single professional kitchen around the world. And even if the plugs are a little bit different in different places, you can't do without that blender.
Do you remember the first set of knives you ever bought?
I remember the first set of knives that I... Well, my mom bought me a set of Global knives, and I remember because there was a knife that I really wanted, and it was sort of a Deba style, which is like the Japanese fish butchering style knife. And I really, really wanted that knife. And so my mom purchased it for me. But then later on, I learned that you can't give a knife as a gift. There's supposed to be a transaction that takes place, because if you give a knife as a gift, apparently it cuts off your friendship. And so every time I gift a knife to someone, and I do this with my cooks a lot because a lot of companies send me knives and things like that, or I buy myself new knives, I'll sell my knives that are, you know, they're not cheap knives. They're fairly expensive, several hundreds of dollars, and I'll sell them for like a dollar to my cooks, or a quarter. So anytime somebody gives you a knife as a gift, make sure you give them a coin, a dollar, something in return for that, and make sure there's a transaction so it doesn't cut off the friendship.
This next story is about tech that you've probably used, and I guess you could say about changing corporate identity. Yahoo, which has not had a great run lately, is exploring selling itself. Right now, the company's been receiving bids from potential buyers. Yahoo's in a weird spot. Earnings announced this week weren't that great. CEO Marissa Mayer has gotten a lot of negative press, and investors are kind of trying to figure out where Yahoo goes from here. To help us unravel this, we've got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood. Hi, Molly.
Glad to be here.
I want to start with a simple question. What is Yahoo?
I think by asking that question, you are now qualified to be CEO of Yahoo because you correctly identified the central issue. If you ask people who use Yahoo's mail and sports fantasy sports sites, they will tell you it's some sort of a product company. If you talk to people who use the front page for news or Yahoo Business or Yahoo Finance, they'll tell you that it's a content company. There's a Yahoo Video site. So it started as the actual classic web portal, a way to get into what was then kind of the developing world of the web, right? You could find links, you could find sites to visit. Then it added email and it added other services around that. It added search. For a long time, you could have said that Yahoo was a search company. But it's not an easy question because now it's all of those things without ever really picking one to focus on.
So you've given us a little bit of the history of the company in that answer. How did this all fall apart?
You know, I think it fell apart, as things so often do, because of that lack of focus. It was hard to figure out where to go from 1995, 1998, 1999. Once the web developed and it didn't need a site like Yahoo to basically point users in the right direction, It was unclear whether they were going to double down on search, whether they were going to become an email provider, whether they were going to go corporate. And nobody seemed to have a good idea. Nobody seemed to have the vision. You know, Google came along as a search company and then said, what we really are is an advertising company. And Yahoo said, maybe we'll get into Hollywood stuff, right? They made Mark Cuban a billionaire by buying broadcast.com and saying, we're gonna do TV and kind of do this Hollywood thing. And it was really that tension between whether Yahoo was a content company with Hollywood ambitions and content ambitions, or a product company that would build great tech products, that kind of brought them down in the end.
Molly, Yahoo has had a string of CEOs. Now we're talking about Marissa Mayer. Why so many leaders? And, you know, we're two women talking about this. Does she get extra criticism because she's a woman?
I think as two women talking about this, we're likely to say that that's probably true. I think she is being in some ways unfairly singled out. She's been very visible, obviously. She's been a very high profile CEO. And I do think in some ways, you know, she lacked the discipline to really do what was necessary at Yahoo and turn it into a product company. But that said, as you point out, there's been a string of CEOs who also failed to turn this company around. You could argue that there's been a decade or more of failure to turn Yahoo around. And so I think to put it all at Marissa Mayer's feet is unfair. She could have been bolder. She could have walked away from some of the content initiatives. She could have thrown fewer parties. But I think to put this all on her is not fair. And in fact, internally, people really liked her. They really thought she was going to do good things for the company. It adds to this perception that there's no good reason why the company is not succeeding. The people are good. They seem to have nothing but money and nothing but users. And there's no good reason why that's not a recipe for success.
There's also a good reason, I guess, that there's so much attention focused on this sale. Lay out for me why someone would want to buy Yahoo.
Well, it sort of depends on who the potential buyer is. We know that Verizon seems like the most likely buyer. And that's because Verizon, you start thinking of Verizon more as AOL, has really gotten into this digital media business and specifically the ad tech business. And AOL has built itself into quite an impressive advertising technology business. And now they want to sort of take on Facebook and Google and become an even bigger advertising company. There are some companies who might be interested in specific parts like Yahoo Japan or maybe just the email part. But it seems like if you're going to buy a bunch of users and you don't know really how to make money off of them, the best possible option is to get them to click on ads.
Molly Wood, our senior tech correspondent, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Beyonce has added another fashion line, Ivy Park, to her empire. She's obviously already got a massive management company, Parkwood Entertainment, and Forbes puts her net worth at no less than $250 million. Ivy Park, though, is her foray into the growing athleisure market. It's been selling out like crazy, but Daniel Belton, an associate editor at The Root and a member of our Marketplace Weekend family, noticed something missing, and she joins me now. Hi, Danielle. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you checked out the Ivy Park line. What did you find?
Well, what I found is that, you know, Beyonce puts out this incredibly cool clothing line. It's this athletic leisure line, and people were ecstatic about it. Like, the products sold out of stores, it crashed, like, the website. But, you know, there was this one thing that stood out to me when I went to look at the clothes was that there were no extended sizes. There was no plus size option, which meant no fun for me personally because, you know, I'm a big girl. I'm a little bit larger than average. And I can't squeeze into a size 12. You know, it only went up to like a 12, 14 extra large. That's their extra large. And so there's no way for me to enjoy it.
This really surprises me, I have to say, as a business decision. One of the things that you pointed out in the story you wrote about this was how big the plus size market is and how much it's going. I mean, the dollar values are pretty eye-popping.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about $17.5 billion in the plus size market. And it's growing. It's been growing steadily. And it's growing, whether you like it or not, for lack of a better word, because the average American continues to get larger. People around the world continue to get larger. And it just makes sense to try to sell clothes to those people if you want to make money. The average size of an American woman is a 14. Ivy Park stops its sizes around like a 12, 14. And, you know, they're essentially just missing out on a lot of money. Like, there's this huge market, and they didn't have to miss out on it. I mean, all they had to do was make a few, like, double XLs and a few triple XLs.
This also seemed to strike a chord with you in particular. You said, like, this is just sad for her fans, too.
Yes. What kind of struck with me is, like, you know, Beyonce's music is for everyone. So yeah. Why isn't her fashion? It just seemed weird to neglect this huge chunk of her audience, you know. And while I don't think people will stop being fans, because ultimately, if you're a fan of Beyonce, you're a fan of her music. But I can see how deeply disappointing that would be to some people. And I honestly hope that she'll look at extending the sizes. I don't know how realistic that is, considering her co-collaborator with Ivy Park is Topshop. And Topshop mm-hmm. does not sell plus sizes.
Yeah, that surprised me. You reached out to the retailers. What did they tell you?
Well, I didn't get a response from Ivy Park or Topshop, but when I reached out to Nordstrom just to kind of find out, are the plus sizes coming down the pipeline? Like, what's going on? And what I kind of got from them is that it's selling off the shelves. They can't keep it. They'd love to sell more more of any capacity of Ivy Park. So, you know, I got the impression that if there were plus sizes, like, Nordstrom would more than happily, you know, sell them for Beyonce. But from what I got from Nordstrom, there's no plans yet to extend the sizes.
One of the things that really strikes me about this is Beyonce has a lot of things, but no one out there can say she is not a smart businesswoman and not someone who has really done a great job, as you mentioned, of being an incredibly inclusive one.
Yes.
And so I think that's where this really surprised me. I even saw people sort of getting into it in the comments on your piece. Someone saying, well, I'm just going to go to Forever 21. And someone else saying, like, oh, no, the Beehive is coming for me if I disagree with this. But it does actually surprise me.
Yeah, I was honestly surprised, too, because I feel like she's been so good about these things lately. She's just been so conscious with, you know, Formation. She was encouraging, you know, Black people to love themselves and to celebrate their heritage. And she's been talking about feminism and Black Lives Matter and all like these incredible things that are very inclusive, that are very all encompassing. And it just seemed like a weird misstep. So I'm hoping that, you know, that she'll make extended sizes. I'm hoping it's not what I think that it is, because often when labels don't refuse pretty much to make plus sizes, it's because often the plus size industry is kind of looked down upon. It's, you know, fashion is very much about the fantasy and the ideal. And for many people in the fashion industry, the ideal is thin. But the reality is you had a lot of people with money to spend and you're saying you just don't want their money. It just doesn't make sense. Like, I compare the fashion industry's stubbornness about plus sizes with integration in baseball, where basically, like, the Red Sox was one of the few teams that just held out as long as they could to integrate, you know, which made no sense because they basically were, like, leaving themselves out of all these great Black ball players that were available. And they're saying, like, nah, I don't want to be competitive. We don't care whether we actually win or not. We just want our team to be white. Like, and that's what it feels like. It's like, I don't want to make that money. I don't want to be rich. You know, I just don't want fat people to wear my clothes. Like, that's the mindset that you're going up against.
Danielle Velton is an associate editor at The Root. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
And we're going out today with a little bit of Prince. There's no real way to sum up his musical genius. So let's just listen. And that's our show for this week. Next week, we're talking paid family leave. What would it mean for you? Visit Marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Ben Tolliday and Bill Lance are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
This is APM.